KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm Dab Stedman, your host, and my guest today is Stephen Wise. Professor Wise is a legal scholar and practicing attorney who for the past 30 years has specialized in animal protection issues. He has taught courses in animal law at several universities, including Harvard and Stanford. He's authored four important books, has been the subject of a documentary film, and speaks at animal rights conferences all over the world. Professor Wise is the former head of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, but is best known as the founder and driving force behind the Non-Human Rights Project, which is our topic for today. I'm honored to welcome you to this program, Professor Wise.
Thank you, and if I may say, I also teach at Lewis and Clark Law School in the summer.
Well, right in our own backyard here. Great. All right, Professor, for the benefit of those listeners who are not already familiar with the Non-Human Rights Project, can you tell us about it? What is your mission and what motivated you to form this organization?
The Non-Human Rights Project is a civil rights organization that focuses on attaining legal rights for at least some non-human animals. And I began it actually in 1996. It was fairly dormant for quite some time until it began to swing into action with planning for its litigation in 2007, and ever since then it's just been kind of going full blast. I thought about it just like I thought about the entire problem that the Non-Human Rights Project addresses, actually in 1985, and that's when I had been litigating animal protection cases for 5 years, and I realized that it would be impossible under current law to be able to protect even the most fundamental interests of any non-human animal, no matter how cognitively complex or what they were or what sort of beings they were. And at that time, I decided that the problem was that they were legal things. They had been legal things for 2,000 years, ever since Roman times. And a legal thing means that that it lacks all ability to have any kind of right. And on the other hand, a legal person is an entity who has the capacity for one or 100 or an infinite number of rights. So non-human animals, as have many human beings at times, were legal things, and all human beings are now legal persons, that they have the capacity for rights. And I thought that non-human animals also, at least some of them, needed to have the capacity for legal rights, or their fundamental interests would not be protected.
And what are those fundamental interests in your way of thinking?
Well, it depends upon which non-human animal you're working with. There's literally a million species of animals, and what might be my fundamental interest a chimpanzee's fundamental interests, you know, a whale's fundamental interests, an elephant's fundamental interests might be very, very different. And when I try to answer those kinds of questions, I go to the scientists who have spent their lives studying them, and I ask those questions. You know, what are their fundamental interests? What are their cognitive capacities? You know, we work hand in hand with many, many scientists around the world, because the facts that underpin our legal arguments are all scientific facts. And so we ask those questions. And it appears that, for example, the great apes, elephants, dolphins and whales, at the very least, they seem to have a fundamental interest in bodily liberty. They hate captivity the way we hate captivity, and in bodily integrity. They don't like to be the victims of assault and battery, you know, any more than we do. So so it seems that, and from an evolutionary standpoint, that would make sense. Certainly it would with respect to such apes as, you know, chimpanzees or gorillas, since we're very close to being, you know, first cousins, if we're not even closer than that.
Yes.
So once we determine what their fundamental interests are, then we try to understand how it is we might be able to begin filing lawsuits that would persuade courts to move them from the capacity of being things who lack the capacity for any legal rights at all, you know, over the line to being persons, which means they have the capacity for rights. And then we begin to litigate as to, you know, which rights, you know, they should have. And we then bring in scientific evidence to inform the courts.
Okay. Now, on your website, on the Non-Human Rights Project website, there's listed five main objectives. Do you want to talk about those a little bit and how you go about achieving those objectives?
Well, I haven't memorized them, so you're going to have to tell me what they are.
Okay, the first one is to change the common law status of great apes, elephants, dolphins, and whales from being mere things in the legal system to legal persons who possess such fundamental rights as bodily liberty and bodily integrity.
Yes, well, that is what I've just been talking about. So I think I've covered that.
Okay, to draw on common law in evolving standards of morality, scientific discovery, and human experience to consider other qualities sufficient for recognition of non-human animal legal personhood and fundamental rights.
Yes, that's because that's how the common law works. The common law, as opposed to statutes or constitutional provisions, the common law is a law that judges make. You know, common law judges, as opposed to, say, civil law judges in the European countries or most of the South American countries, many Asian countries. Common law is the law that judges make. Our judges can actually make law, like the Supreme Court of Oregon, you know, makes the law, and or at least makes some of the law, and the law that it makes is called the common law. And the common law is supposed to be flexible. It's supposed to change. Judges are supposed to change in order to meet the changes in the world, the changes in human experience, the evolving of public morality, the accrual of new scientific discoveries. And so we argue that that the judges should be changing the common law as respects to personhood and the rights of non-human animals the way they should change the common law to meet changing needs of human beings as well.
Yes, and I know that we've had other guests on this program who have talked about the ever-blurring lines between human and non-human animals, so that would be part of this scientific discovery and evolution. Another objective that you list on the Non-Human Rights Project website is to develop local, national, and global issue-oriented grassroots campaigns to promote recognition of non-human animals as beings worthy of moral and legal consideration.
Indeed. We have been filing our lawsuits at the state level. We have lawsuits in New York State now for 5 years. For the last 6 months, we began lawsuits in Connecticut. We're going to be filing lawsuits in California. And I think in California, we're also beginning to try to have ordinances passed at the municipal level, say in the San Francisco City Council or the LA City Council or the San Diego City Council, in which those city councils will actually pass an ordinance that declares that a certain non-human animal, whether it's a chimpanzee or a whale or a dolphin or an elephant or whatever species, is a person or has certain kinds of rights, like the right to bodily liberty. And then at that point, we would try to move them into sanctuaries that would be appropriate for them. Mm-hmm. So we're beginning to work, at the city level, we also are looking at engaging in referendums whereby the people of a city in certain states might be able to vote so that in order to make certain non-human animals persons or to give them certain kinds of rights. And we also are working with legal organizations and lawyers around the world. I'm almost in constant motion meeting with those folks, whether they're in Argentina or Sweden or India or UK or Spain, Australia. We work with them see the best way of having them be able to have non-human animals become legal persons and rights bearers in their countries, and then we continue to work with them.
Yeah, and what you just said encompasses the fourth pillar of your objectives, to build a coalition of organizations and individuals to secure legally recognized fundamental rights for non-human animals. And the last pillar, shall we say, of your program would be to foster understanding of the social, historical, political, and legal justice of your arguments and the scientific discovery of other species' cognitive and emotional complexity.
Indeed, we try to do two main things there. One is we work with scientists who study the species of non-human animals with whom we work, and try to have work with them so that we understand the cognitive complexity, and also it keeps changing all the time because more and more scientists are doing more and more work on the cognitive complexity of many species of non-human animals, and it usually only goes one way. They're appearing to be more cognitively complex than people knew. And then we tried to situate the struggle that we're involved in, which is a civil rights struggle for the personhood and the fundamental legal rights of non-human animals. We try to situate that within the social history, within the political history of the struggle of human beings, many kinds of human beings, for centuries, who were actually treated like animals, literally. And we're saying, those entities, those human beings should not have been treated like animals, and animals should not be treated like animals either. And they all have a certain measure of dignity that needs to be respected, in the law. And we situate our civil rights struggle within the context of centuries of other civil rights struggles.
Yeah, well, it's a big topic, and you've tied it together beautifully. We're going to take just a very short break now, so everyone, please stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals. We're talking with legal scholar Professor Stephen Wise, founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, about his lifelong work to gain personhood status in the eyes of the court for certain animals. Professor, because you were starting from scratch, so to speak, in the mid-1980s, with no animal rights case law or cadre of animal rights lawyers to support your efforts, what groundwork did you have to do before you were able to take your first personhood rights case to court on behalf of an actual animal plaintiff, I guess we'd say?
That is an excellent question, and it perhaps explains why it took us 28 years from the time that I came up with the idea until the time we actually started filing them. If you bring yourself back to 1985, it was the way you said it was. And so one thing that had to be done is that there had to be courses that were in law schools. And the first time I was able to teach at a law school was at the Vermont Law School in 1990, and I think I taught the second class that had ever been taught concerning non-human animals. By the time I was teaching at Harvard, I taught the first class at Harvard in 2000. There were perhaps 10 of them. And now, you know, when I taught at Stanford last April, there were perhaps 150 of them throughout the United States. So it needed to be accepted within the legal profession as being a field that was worthy of study. And I think it generally has been. Lawyers, at least formally, try to communicate with each other and with the judges through law review articles, which are really published through law schools. Lewis and Clark has several of them. And those needed to be started. Lewis and Clark had actually one of the very first, if not the first, actually animal law review. I think it's now been going on for more than 20 years. And so there had to be law review articles that were published in animal law journals, but also published in many other kinds of journals. So, you know, I think I've written like 22 law review articles over the last 30 years on all sorts of issues related to why non-human animals should have rights. Then there books had to be written about it, you know, popular books. So I started writing those books. One of my books was, you know, featured on the cover of the Sunday New York Times book review. They were reviewed, you know, widely. That's another way of just having people begin to, you know, hear your arguments again and again and again, because non-human animals have been legal things, you know, for 2,000 years. It takes people a while to be, you know, lawyers and judges too, to begin to understand why, you know, that was the wrong thing to do. An organization had to be formed, so the Non-Human Rights Project was formed, and then we had to choose which animals, you know, were appropriate to be our initial plaintiff. We had to figure out, you know, what causes of action, why we end up now suing under the writ of habeas corpus. But that was not clear as to what would be the cause of action. And for many reasons, we chose a writ of habeas corpus, you know, under the common law.
Mm-hmm.
We had to decide where we were going to file suit.
Yeah, but the concept of the court recognizing non-humans as persons is not a new one. I think anybody listening who is familiar with Citizens United knows that corporations have been deemed as persons. Do you want to give some other examples of non-humans that are legally recognized as persons?
Yes. There are more and more. While lawyers have always known, you know, that, or at least for the last century or so, that corporations are persons, for many reasons, they never had these kinds of free speech rights. And when Citizens United kind of came out, for most people, or for many people, that was the first time they realized that corporations were persons, that they had various kinds of common law statutory and now, you know, First Amendment rights. There are in New Zealand, for example, treaties and now statutes in which a certain river, the Whanganui River, within the last year, 2 years, was made a person in New Zealand. A national park has been made a person. In the United States, ships are persons, counties are persons. Probably the state of Oregon is a person, or the city of Portland is a person. In India, the Indian Supreme Court held that the holy books of the Sikh religion is a person, and other courts had held that a mosque was a person, or that a Hindu idol was a person. And now, since the Non-Human Rights Project has begun filing lawsuits, you know, there have been other people filing some lawsuits in other countries as well. In Argentina, last year, a chimpanzee named Cecilia,
yeah,
was found to be a non-human person pursuant to a writ of habeas corpus, and was ordered released from a zoo in Mendoza, Argentina, and sent to a sanctuary. An orangutan named Sandra at a lower court was found to be a person. A speckled bear named Chucho in Colombia is now, the question is whether he is a person. And the first court said no, the second court said yes, the third court said no, and we're now waiting for the for the fourth court.
So it's definitely not a big leap to pursue having legal rights for certain animals then. Professor, what types of animals are the most likely candidates for personhood, and why is that?
Well, I think there's at least two different theories on that. You know, we believe that the non-human animals who we can show are autonomous, that they are extraordinarily cognitively complex to the point that they can choose how to live their lives. They remember what happened yesterday. They know what's happening today. They can anticipate what's happening tomorrow. They can live their lives in an autonomous way. We think because of the fact that states and common law countries, whether it's Oregon or whether it's New York or California or England, that courts, as do legislators, even and at international treaty level too, really value autonomy extraordinarily much. So what we do is then begin looking for scientists who can talk to us about which non-human animals might be cognitively complex, very cognitively complex, to the point of being autonomous. And you know, we have experts with respect to elephants, African elephants, Asian elephants, chimpanzees, bonobos, likely orangutans, gorillas, orcas, you know, other kinds of whales, and perhaps other non-human animals as well. So that's the theory that we've been using. There's another theory that perhaps the non-human animals who people have brought in as members of their families might be the best candidates, like dogs, for example, or cats. We don't agree, and we think that they are less likely, and so we're not litigating on behalf of dogs and cats as test cases. You know, for right now, that doesn't mean that we won't. And
but you did litigate on behalf of a chimpanzee named Tommy. And what compelled you to choose him as a subject of your first personhood case?
What we did is we ended up deciding that we wanted to litigate in the state of New York. And we wanted to litigate on behalf of chimpanzees. And we first decided to litigate on behalf of two chimpanzees who are in a roadside zoo named Reba and Merlin. And then when we did that, it turned out over the next few months, first one and then the second one died. Then what we decided to do was to try to locate every chimpanzee who was in the state of New York and essentially file a simultaneous habeas corpus lawsuits on behalf of them. And Tommy was the first one we found. We found him in a cage in like a warehouse structure on a used trailer lot in a small town in New York State. And he ended up being our first plaintiff.
Yeah, and I know it's you've been to court many, many, many times to pursue this case. And after 5 years of legal proceedings, do you feel that you're getting closer to reaching your goals? And if so, why?
Yes. Well, there's lots of reasons why. For one reason, when we began in 2013. Nobody had ever heard of such a thing. And now the idea that someone might file a lawsuit, a well-thought-out lawsuit that could possibly win on behalf of a non-human animal, is accepted throughout the United States and to a significant degree throughout the world. That's one of the reasons that we're now working with lawyers in so many countries. For example, we know that between March 1st and September 30th of last year, there were 2,095 articles about us in the press that discussed our work.
That's impressive, yes.
All over the world. We know that when we went to look at law review articles and books, we know that there's been more than 100 law review articles and books that have discussed our work. So we've begun to catalyze a movement and have begun the process of getting people, judges, including judges, professors, lawyers and general population, used to the idea that you can make really powerful arguments.
The first very important step, yes.
Well, things can't be done unless people think that they can possibly be done. And that's the first thing we need to do, is to change people's attitude from saying this can't be done to, well, I guess it can be done if you're doing it right, or it could be done under certain kinds of circumstances. And so we are deeply into that. Then there are, you know, even if we don't win an entire case, and we try to, but oftentimes we just simply can't, then we look to see what parts of the case that can we win that we can use later on, you know, for other cases.
To build on,
so,
yeah.
For example,
yeah.
One of the most important obstacles that constantly, perturbs animal protection lawyers and environmental lawyers is the doctrine in the United States, at least, of standing. That the only one who can bring a lawsuit has to be, first of all, they have to be a person, and second of all, they have to be the injured party. And so that makes it very difficult in the United States to sue on behalf of a non-human animal, because the human being is a person, but generally is not the one being injured, while the non-human animal is being injured, but is not a person. And that's the problem that has haunted, you know, everybody for a long, long time, both in the animal protection and in the environmental movement. And one of the things that we did establish within the state of New York was, for the first time, you know, using a common law writ of habeas corpus, judges have agreed that we had standing, that the Non-Human Rights Project had standing to sue on behalf of an injured non-human animal, even though we were not the ones who were being injured.
That's huge. That's very significant. And let me ask you, if you do win personhood for Tommy at some point,
we will.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Yes, I know you will. But what will the consequences on his life be?
They'll be extraordinary. Tommy will be moved from where he is, which is likely, in a cage. He will be moved to a sanctuary called Save the Chimps, which is about 100 miles north of me. You know, I'm north of Fort Lauderdale, in South Florida, where he will live on a 3 to 5 acre island, because there's 13 of these islands, along with 24 other chimpanzees. He'll live in the Florida sun on 3 to 5 acres, and he will be part of a community of chimpanzees instead of living in a cage, in a northern climate, all by himself. It's like putting you or I into solitary confinement, for the rest of our lives.
Okay. And one more question, because we're running out of time. When you and those following in your footsteps eventually do achieve this main objective, what impact will such a legal victory have on the millions of other animals that are experiencing captivity and exploitation or abuse every day of their lives?
Super question. We argue, for example, now that animals like Tommy or the elephants or orcas ought to have legal rights because they are autonomous beings. But we're very careful to argue that autonomy is a sufficient condition for rights, in that autonomous beings should have rights, but we never argue that it's a necessary condition, that only autonomous beings can have rights. And so we're positive that there are many other grounds for granting rights to non-human animals that do not include autonomy. And
okay, excuse me, Professor Weiss, I'm really sorry, but we are out of time now. So what I'm going to do is post on the KBOO Voices for the Animals program page and on our Facebook page contact information for your organization, because I'm sure that some of our listeners are going to want to help you somehow achieve this important milestone for animals. So I thank you so very much for being our guest today and for all the important work you're doing to break down that legal wall that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom.
You are welcome. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, thanks. This is Dab Stedman thanking all of you for listening to Voices for the Animals today. To hear any of our past broadcasts, just go online to kboo.fm and look for audio programs. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals.
This program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio is available online at kboo.fm.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Matthew of KBOO's bedtime story show Gremlin Time looks at the horror film The Bat with Vincent Price, recently released on DVD. And in the book corner, we look at a great new book on the films of Preston Sturges. But first, Jeff Goss.